I do agree with you, Bill. I think maybe a podcast is best. Can we podcast via Vox? Like, can we take our conversations like this, and then can you download them and turn them into the podcast? That would be pretty efficient and really cool.
And that's what we did. John and I Voxed back and forth. You'll hear how we did it when we did it, but I'm pretty excited. I think it's pretty rad. So I even introduce it in Voxer, so I'll just let myself take over.
Hi, and welcome to Bill Selleck Talks. I am Bill Selleck, and on this episode, this very special episode, we have John Carippo. You may know him as the director of professional learning for Q. You may know him as Obi-Wan Carippo. John and I are going to be recording in Voxer, not in real time, not face-to-face, not even with, well, I guess fancy microphones, because the microphones, like, microphone in your phone is a good one these days. But all in Voxer. So we're going to take a risk, try something new. I'm excited. This started off when I was talking with John on Voxer about theme, about STEM, about how it fits in, where it fits in. So I have not actually podcasted in Voxer, so I guess I'll just stop. John, hey there.
Hey, Bill. I'm glad that on take two you got your name right. I'm currently in line to get on an airplane from San Diego to Reno. So you're right. We don't have to be in the same room. I love STEAM stuff. My name is John, and I do a lot of education stuff all over the place, and I do not live in the world that thinks everybody agrees with my opinion. So I'm going to be sharing some things that maybe makes people scratch their chinny chin chins, and I'm okay with that.
So this all started in my head earlier this week when I got an email from a friend who is a principal, and she was asking about how you can move forward with STEAM. We have all these ideas, went to the National IQ Conference, we're excited, now what? Like, where does this fit in? How do we do it? And at the same time, I was hearing people talk about, like, oh, we do, like, an after-school robotics club, we have this after-school making thing. It occurred to me that you need to just go for it. Like, STEAM isn't what you do in addition to math, that becomes your math. So John, we talked about math before. What are your thoughts on math and STEAM? And then you talked about bootstrap before. Love to hear a bit more about that.
Oh, great leadoff question, Bill. I hope you got the picture of me sitting on the plane right now. Shut our Wi-Fi down.
Let's go take good care of you, and I hope everybody's getting ready for a great weekend.
So since the pilot just interrupted John, I'm going to interrupt this entire podcast for just a moment. It's amazing that we can actually go back and forth and record a podcast that goes to iTunes, that goes to my website, everywhere, just by talking back and forth in this little silly app that lets you walkie-talkie style chat back and forth. It's amazing, right? Yes. All right. John re-recorded. He picked it up a little bit later. He'll talk about where he podcasted, where he recorded, where he voxed a little bit later at the end of this podcast, but it's kind of amazing. It's totally amazing.
Okay, so Bill, you mentioned Bootstrap, and what I like about Bootstrap is it's a free OER resource. It is Common Core aligned, whether you like Common Core or not. It's a great project-based approach to math, and kids learn the skills like XY coordinates. They learn about variables. They learn about coordinate plane, all those kinds of things that an English teacher like me likes to spout off, but the kids learn them in context. They don't learn them just because. They learn them just in time in the context of building something, and my logic here is that's a form of flipping, right? Isn't it flipping the instruction to have the kids do the thing, and then possibly do the boring worksheet aspect to prove mastery? Couldn't you flip that? Why do we have to do worksheets to build up to the cool thing?
And I think that the trick with what you said is that it's in context. You know, we don't have to just learn this thing and read about it. We can actually experience it and make it. And I think that's been the big shift that technology's given us. The thing that jumps to my mind is when I was teaching elementary music, we would write songs, not all the time, but that in-context learning of let's write something, now let's take a step back. Here's what you actually just did. Let's dig a little bit deeper. And now that you understand this thing, we could actually make it cooler. So like 16th notes were an interesting part of that. You know, a student had a lyric that was like da-da-da-da-da. And so it was, all right, here's actually what you just said. Here's what 16th notes are. We talked for like half an hour about them a couple months ago. Here's some interesting things about 16th notes. Here's a couple different patterns. Do we want just this one pattern or something else? And suddenly students really, really cared about it because it was with that one rhythm they just came up with for the song we were writing. And it actually, it gave context to learning. And as we know, when you actually have context, you actually remember it. You know, like, what are those pitiful stats? We only remember like 5% of what we learn like a year later when it comes to just memorizing stuff. But stuff we care about, we tend to remember because there's a context. There's other reasons too, but I think context is the key. And that's part of the magic of Minecraft too, right?
And yes, Bill, I'm glad you asked about Minecraft. The way I've seen Minecraft deployed a lot of times is kind of the same way we saw Oregon Trail deployed, or heck, even iMovie, where the pedagogical approach is, if you guys are good and you're quiet for X amount of days or weeks or worksheets or whatever, then yes, we can do a fun activity on Friday like Minecraft. And I think, I just don't think that's right thinking. I think it should look like this. I think it should look like we are going to do awesome Minecraft all week to learn about our history by building, like John Miller's kids do, building a pirate island or a Viking island, to actually explore the content in Minecraft all week. And then maybe, again, you do some kind of a test or some kind of a project based on that real experience, is what you do on Friday. You don't wait till Friday to do the fun stuff. You do the fun stuff all week. And I'm going out of sequence on this one, but I just think it's really important to not have engineering, STEAM, coding, robotics, that stuff can't be a club anymore, I don't think. I'm just arguing this case here that once a school says, oh, we have a coding club, I'm not sure there's enough center of gravity or mass to move it to being a mainstream class. And we really need STEAM, STEM kind of mindsets for coding and, engineering and frankly, just everyday life nowadays is far more technical. And it reflects what the kids' reality is. They're technical kids. All kids today are pretty much technical kids. So I'm not sure why we wouldn't use the highest form of motivation possible.
Yes. Yes, definitely. So that's the mind shift, I think, for teachers to look at all these things as not extra things or just fun things. But I think it's also important for administrators to have this shift so that when they come in and see kids playing on Minecraft and making and doing all these really intricate, elaborate, collaborative, creative, problem-solving things, that's what they see. They don't see, oh, those kids are having fun. When I was in the classroom teaching second grade, I had an administrator that actually pulled me aside and said, you know, these leprechaun traps are actually a fire hazard, so they need to go. And I'm glad you're doing this fun stuff, but you really need to focus on the learning. And what she missed, because, you know, like there's the way we went to school and the way we went to our credential classes, and it was, this is what learning looks like. And I feel like that's the old model, right? So the new model and the thing we did, which was such a cool project, we read The Night Before St. Patrick's Day, Natasha Wing. Awesome book, and the kids build leprechaun traps. So the question from a second grader, and this was totally just, you know, flexible going with it. I had not planned this. I'm not, you know, nearly that insightful. Student raises a hand. Well, can we build leprechaun traps? Well, yes, yes, we can, right? Just like that improv game where you play yes and. The answer is yes. Yes, we can build leprechaun traps. So we did. And they had to actually have some sort of mechanism to actually catch a leprechaun. And that took two entire afternoons. They spent like 5 hours on these traps. And then Leprechaun Day came, St. Patrick's Day, and it was amazing, you know. And we actually didn't catch one, but a couple got knocked over. A trash can was overturned. A desk got overturned as the leprechaun was trying to escape. It was crazy. And then the follow up to that, we actually looked at which ones worked, which ones didn't work, why they worked, why they didn't work. Students wrote about that. And then the icing on the cake, we had a mystery location call, like mystery Skype, mystery hangout, with the author, Natasha Wing. And the entire second grade actually squeezed into my little portable classroom. And if you don't know about mystery location calls, there's a great Infinite Thinking Machine episode on those. I know, John, you know, but for people listening. So yeah, I think that's the idea of this new model of learning can be fun along the way, and learning happens in the context of these interesting things.
And yeah, that's another good point, Bill. I mean, doesn't this extend to robotics too? The old model would be, you know, we'll study about robots and we'll learn about the history of robots, and then we'll do some kind of thing on robots. And then at the very end, we'll spend a few hours working on robots. You can flip that too. What if learning about robots by building them first to create a sense of interest, intensity, ability to kind of really reflect on what's going down with the robots, and then you learn the history. Well, don't you think that's better?
You know what that reminds me of? Reminds me of how Ramsey Musallam approaches flipping in his high school chemistry classes. It's not just let me flip and then do some work, where like the videos at home and then the activities in class. He adds a component before that, explore, flip, apply, where you do something where it's like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. Wait, how did you do that? How did that explode with, I don't know, a rainbow flame? And Ramsey's like, oh, that's a good question. If you watch my video tonight, you'll have the answer. So it creates this intense desire to learn from the students. We're like, I must know how this works and why this works. And like, what? But if you don't have that need, then you tend to just not care. And even if you do memorize it for a test or for a worksheet or for a quiz, you're not going to remember it, right? So then here's the question. We used to just have like lecture and then homework. And so we had this extra component of like, here's this really interesting robotics activity or chemistry experiment or something. This explore part where we're having this in context learning. When do we do that? When do we have time for that? What, like, if we add this, then what goes?
Yeah, well, here's the deal. I have concerns about flipped classroom, even though I've been a proponent of the concept for years. But my concern with flipping is that, first, I don't know how sustainable it is to come up with a fire rainbow every day. I don't know how much I can make that happen. Let's say, for example, I'm teaching Latin roots or plate tectonics or, I don't know, compound sentences or positives. I'm not sure I can blow the kids away that to that level every day. So that's why I think it's critical to talk about, you know, the overall workflow of the class and being able to pivot, like you were talking about, when the kid says, can we do that? And we do. I'll give you a kind of a good example. When I was teaching sixth grade, and I was really into Latin roots with the kids at that point, but my goal was to make Latin roots, you know, lively and full of life, not just boring and flat. And one of the things that I had on the little weekly quiz, because, you know, when you're doing Latin roots, you gotta kind of have a little weekly quiz of some sorts. Nowadays, I probably would have moved to more of a practical final. But either way, we needed a little quiz. And at the end, I thought, hey, it'd be fun to take two or three of your Latin roots this week and use the root to come up with a totally new root, right? So what happened was the kids started really getting into it, and they were stringing together 10, 11, 12 Latin roots to make up entirely new words. Now, they were kind of nonsense words, but they were totally owning the definitions. And so I was able to go with that, right? So you could have never seen that coming, that would be a weekly competition between the kids. And it was very much the whole class. And I kept telling them, dude, you only need to have two or three, and they would have 10 or 11. So the problem with flipping in mass is you can't have fire rainbows or fire rainbow lessons every week, much less every day. It makes it really tricky. So so the part you got to do is, how do you sustain that, right? How do you sustain that creativity and that kind of stuff? So I don't think kids are going to go home and watch a video about compound sentences. I mean, even with 4 billion videos, that's going to be tough sledding on YouTube. So I think that's where you've got to figure out how to delight and surprise the kids with the workflow every day. And like, what is the task? Because the content is just not always going to be that sexy. And that's where I've had a lot of fun with things like 8 Parts and Iron Chef, where the activity itself is fun and we just change the context a little bit of what we're working on. So just some ideas for you guys that are listening to this asymmetrical podcast. And then to get around to actually answering your question finally, Bill, I think that, you ask about the time thing, and the bottom line is we all get 168 hours a week. So something else has to go. You can't do all of this. You can't continue to teach all of the boxed curriculum or all of the regular quote, finger quotes up, regular stuff. You've got to start moving it in so that you can get two or three things done at once. And so that's where I talk a lot to people about the idea that in the classic CST, which is the California State Standards Testing Environment, I saw a lot of teachers try to do it this way. Today we'll do 1.3. Tomorrow we'll do 1.4. Friday we'll be up to 1.9. And I just don't think you can get there that way. And that's one of the neat things about STEAM, STEM, project-based stuff, is that if you design it well, kids are picking up 20, 30, 40 standards sometimes on a single project, which is really cool. Iron Chefing, how many standards are you covering when kids can make a slide based on research in 10 minutes on a portion of the content that they're working on? So they're making a Google slide, they're researching, they're summarizing, they're taking notes, they're doing attribution, and you're doing 10, 15 standards in one quick shot. That's when it gets really, really cool.
And I think the part that I would add to that is that when you feel like you have to cover this, when you have that intense pressure put upon yourself or administration that you have to cover certain content, and you do 1.3, 1.4, the next day, anyone guess? 1.5. It just is, like, I don't want to say depressing, but it's depressing, like, for a teacher, for students. I don't know that there's that much learning going on. And that's how I started off. I feel like that's how we're all told to start teaching, that that's what teaching looks like, that that's what learning looks like. And I just really question how much learning is actually happening. Yes, you cover the content, like you said, the words. The students heard the words, and they did the worksheet that proves they heard the words. And it kind of stops there. But if you're able to break it open, I think the interesting thing that really happens with that is that instead of, and in a similar way with your Iron Chefing, instead of just like, let me learn these two little standards that I picked out, those two standards become super tiny and super not a big deal. It's like, well, of course I got that. Did you see the other 20 that I got? Come on now. Come on now. I think that's really where the magic of it is. So the question is then, how do you take that first step out? How do you do that? Like, I'm picturing that new movie, new to me, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, The Walk, where the dude walked on a tightrope between the Twin Towers, like in the early 80s. You know, like there's that one point, and I know we've seen this inspirational education quote, when like your weight is shifted onto the building, and at some point you have to shift your weight onto the tightrope. How do we do that? Like, how do we actually shift our weight away from fidelity to the curriculum and change that to fidelity to the student?
Yeah, Bill, I agree on the drudgery aspect, because it really takes all of the excitement and fun and sense of adventure out of the learning when you do the 1.3, 1.4, 1.5. And I understand, especially in larger districts, it's scary for admins to make sure that that everybody's moving ahead on an efficacious process and that there's consistency between schools and all that. In fact, I'll sidebar a little bit here. You will hear this phrasing a lot. Well, we have to be consistent, because what if a kid from another school in our district transfers in? And I would just like to extend this, just a good rhetorical question, which I think you will actually go ahead and answer, is what do we do when kids transfer in from outside of our district? So really, does it matter that much if we write our essays this way or that way? Don't those kids from out of our district adapt? So I don't know why it's so important that all of the schools be the same. And I'm going to credit this one to Tim Gorey, that he talked to me. We were driving somewhere. We were doing a job up at NorCal. And he said he realized that all of their schools were trying to compete at being the same. And how do you be better at being the same? So we've got to get rid of the concept of sameness, because it's what's really holding us back. When a district says, oh, yeah, we'd love to do that, but I don't know, we can't afford the PD for both high schools or both K-8s, or what will we do about consistency? And my answer is, who cares? Well, let's stop competing at being the best at being the same. Do you hear the oxymoron going there?
Yes, yes, yes. And along that same train of thought, we as educators are called to differentiate our instruction, because no two students are the same. And on the other hand, we need to make sure that every student knows the same thing and is taught the same thing the same way. And it just doesn't work. I've heard you talk about shooting video, and this reminds me a lot of that. If you create an environment where students are able to almost go through just kind of a playlist of, here's the 18 most famous shots in movies. Go shoot these. Then here's the next little thing. Now go make a movie. And once they have these basic skills under their belt, they're able to make these amazing things. I think it keeps going back to creating things instead of just being able to complete a worksheet or, you know, like take this quiz. Students are showing their mastery by creating all these artifacts. And hopefully, and here's where I think it gets really exciting, hopefully showing their learning along the way. I hate to call it just a digital portfolio, but something like a blog, tweets, something, a Google Doc that they publish and share, something where they're saying, here's where I started, and I'm going, and here's how I'm amazing now. That feels so insanely powerful.
Well, yes, I totally agree. And here's another bit of input for you. I think when we do a different project or thing every day or every week or all the time, we deny kids mastery. And so they're always in this layer of, I kind of don't know what we're doing today, but I'm faking it because I don't want to fail. That's some pretty bad operant conditioning for people's, like, their ego and their sense of self-worth. So one of the things I did with that shooting gallery was, that was the first project of the year every year. It was also the project we did coming out of Christmas break. And then once the kids that came back they went from Media 1 to Media 2, guess what the first project was? Yep, shooting gallery again, except now they had more fancy cameras. On the first round, they just shot it with their phone. Now we moved to an actual video camera. And guess what they did coming out of spring break or Christmas break their sophomore year? Oh, yeah, we did the shooting gallery again, except now they were skilled up. And their junior year, we repeated the process, except now they were on the DSLRs, the really fancy cameras. And now they had several reps, so they knew what was coming. And it's amazing to see the progression on kids when you give them a chance to do something four or five times. And here's the best example I could think of. Imagine that if your football team played one game a year. It'd be nuts, right? Imagine if any sports team played one game a year. How good would we be? Even if we practiced the whole season and it all led up to one game, would we be as good on the second game if we didn't play the first game? It's just not possible.
You know, it sounds like the inverse of spiral review. Instead of, oh, let's make sure you still remember it, it's no. Here's kind of this template. Do it again. All right, let's do it again. A little bit later, let's do it again. God, what a super cool way of scaffolding, right? Even like within the same class, if you had students with different skill levels doing that same thing again and again, that's cool. That's some powerful learning.
I really like that phrasing, Bill, the inverse of spiral review, because spiral review is just in case, right? It's like, oh, well, maybe you will need this for the test. It's not very inspiring, right? But if it's like it's Friday night, it's pizza night, that's a whole other thing, because we're going to bust this thing open. We're going to have a whole new kind of pizza this week. I had that kind of pizza last week. And people like patterns, and we deny kids patterns a lot of times. We'll do the science report one time a year. We'll do the state report one time a year. So everybody's always living in, I'm not sure if we're doing this right, because it's Rev 1 all the time.
I love that. I feel like that hits on one of the big things when we talk about STEAM and like, how do you enter into this? How do you start to make it kind of part of your classroom, your school's culture? I think giving students that opportunity to attack an open-ended problem where there isn't that one right answer, right? Like, it's such a subtle shift. Just do it again. And I would argue not even easy A, just, yeah, do it faster for free time. I don't know, something, but yes.
Oh, those are great thoughts, Bill. I totally agree, too. I think that one of the biggest ones is a sense of being able to learn with the kids. So the model of, oh, I spent 3 weekends learning Photoshop so that I can teach the first class. No, it's more like this. It's like, let's open that puppy up and see what we can do with it. And I will tell you that I have taught and learned multiple apps, including Final Cut, just that way, where I'm literally doing the tutorials with the kids. It's a very, what I like to call a, since I said what I like to call, I should know what it is, but it's a very studio kind of feel. It is not a regimented classroom, but we're kind of chilling our way through the tutorials. We have time frames, we have daily goals, but, you know, some people are going faster and slower, and some people are figuring something out, and other people are running over going, oh my gosh, that's so cool, show me. But I think that sense of wonder, that sense of going with the flow, but also having a timeline, I think that's some of the big changes we're looking at.
Totally reminds me of how LeVar Burton ended his closing keynote a few years ago at National Q. I forget the exact start of it, but it was like, you know, I don't know what this is. I don't know how to do this, but let's figure this out together. And that felt so powerful that we don't have to know it all. And as teachers, I feel like there's this pressure that we have to be the experts. We have to be the experts at student learning and student engagement. We don't have to be content knowledge experts anymore. I don't know that that's even possible.
So, Bill, yeah, I agree that, you know, the old model was, look at me, I'm the content expert. But I want everybody that's listening, all three or four of you listening to this podcast, I want you to picture a Venn diagram. And on the Venn diagram, you have the classic teachers. On over on this side, you've got kind of the content crazy man. So like maybe Jaime Escalante, right? Content, and we're going to work on Saturdays, and it's going to be 90 hours a week. I'm going to make it happen. And then on the other end of the Venn diagram, you've got the Robin Williams Dead Poets Society, kind of Pied Piper. I'm going to be in your life. You're going to write songs about your girlfriend because of me, you know. And I think that the modern, right now, contemporary teacher is both. You have to have content skills, but you have to be able to lead people through amazing experiences, because that's what they've been trained by. Starbucks, Disneyland, Universal Studios, movies. People need amazing experiences. They expect it. And so it's not enough to just dryly be the content expert anymore and have people kind of pray at your golden idol of content and have them be amazed at your content, because the smartest kids in that content-based class will get on Google and out-ramp the content-based teacher. So it's like you said, it's impossible to be the content master, but you can be the experience master. And I think that's really a good way to round this out, that in the long run, the content, you know, if you know all your content, but you can't get people to be excited about it and choose to learn about it, ooh, a lot of crickets in that classroom.
John, that is an amazing point. I think that's why teaching is as much an art as a science. It reminds me of what John Lennon said about music. And I know this from the movie The Departed, or The Departed. You know, you give me a tuba and I'll bring you something out of it. You know, it doesn't matter what you put in front of a good teacher. A good teacher is going to be able to teach those students. And you need to know enough of the content to lead them and to help kind of craft their learning. But once you get that, then, you know, it's at this point, and with this thing called Google, have you heard of the Google? It's pretty cool stuff. You don't have to be a content master anymore. The more you are, the deeper you can really like fine-tune a student learning experience. That just goes right back, you know, a nice little bow on this podcast. It goes right back to what you were talking about when Final Cut Pro came out. You learned it with your students. It's an amazing thing to be able to do that. And that's, I think, where you shift towards being more of an artist as an educator and responding to your students and kind of crafting that learning experience. So final thoughts, wondering about a project you could share with our listeners that's just like, wow, that's really stinking cool. Maybe someday kind of project, and then something with like $10, $20 at Amazon, or just, you know, like spare parts in your room that you already have. Can't get going on a really nice and steamy activity. I'll go first. I saw just yesterday this amazing collaboration at our school. Geometry teacher got together, and at Hillbrook, we hired a part-time engineer. She comes in and helps with electives and little kind of one-off things. Her name's Shay Ellerson. She's amazing. So she got together with the math teacher. They did some coding in Python to dive a little bit deeper, a lot deeper actually, into fractals. And so they actually coded fractals using Python. We got a beautiful design and then sent that to our laser cutter and etched it into some acrylic and then mounted that in our front admin building. So it's amazing. One other piece that I love with that is there's a paragraph explaining what they did, why they did that, and why it looks the way it does. So cross-curricularly, you get engineering, math, art, and language arts. And then STEAM-wise, it's almost all of it. I don't know as much the science, but it's, you know, technology, engineering, arts, and math. Super cool. So I understand that most schools do not have a laser cutter, or a part-time engineer that can help with other things. But one thing that I am really excited about is paper circuitry. I think Joanne Fox called it tape something. I had it and I lost it. I'll figure it out. I'll throw it in the show notes. Like tape engineering something. Anyway, I call it paper circuitry, and that's why that's all I remember. The idea is you get copper tape, you get a watch battery, you get a couple LEDs that are super duper cheap, and you can actually draw a circuit, and then you just put the copper tape on top of it. It's copper, and then it's sticky on the other side, so copper tape. And you just draw a very simple circuit, put the tape over the circuit, there's an LED at some point, and then depending on what you put on top of it, it can be like a clown, and then the LED is red, and you poke it through so that's the nose, or have it kind of be behind it, kind of glows with one piece of paper on top of another piece of paper. And then when you push on like his toe or something, that closes the circuit and his nose lights up. Super cool, surprisingly easy to do. And that's a really cool mashup of engineering and art. So, John, what do you got?
I really like your idea. Yes, I like that a lot. And I've got a kind of a different flavor on it. So this is not something I did. John Sparks, the tech teacher over at Minarets High School, did this one. And it was great. It was just so simple and just so elegant and just so cool. So basically, he got a hold of Hot Wheels axles and wheels. So I don't even know, probably Amazon or something. You can buy Hot Wheel axles and wheels. Then he had his high school kids, he gave them a certain size parameter, and they had to design any kind of car they wanted, but it had to fit in this size of a box. Well, the size of the box was about the size of a Hot Wheel. So you had kids, one kid designed his Hot Wheel was a food truck. And yes, there was a door on the side. Another kid designed his as he printed around a flash drive. And so I think his car was called the Flash Car or something like that. And so kids were designing all kinds of different cars and then printing them out in 3D and hot gluing the axles on. Then he got a hold of the Hot Wheel speedometry lessons. And so you have high school kids doing speedometry stuff in their technology class. And you just Google speedometry. And so he had a whole bunch of like rate problems and acceleration things and calculating speed and stuff like that. And I just thought that was a really cool activity, because here you got kids basically for the price of some axles and filament, which, as you know, it goes a long ways. It's pretty affordable. They were working in a CAD program. They had total freedom to design whatever their heart felt like was the best, coolest thing, kind of like Pinewood Derby. They printed it, they had to assemble it, and then they did the math piece. And I think the culminating activity was they had to do either a tutorial on what they had learned in Tinkercad or SketchUp and explain how they built their car. So now here you go. You got art, steam, math, English, you got all that stuff. It's all steamed up together. So I thought that was a pretty cute little trick.
That's fantastic. It's like the Filament Derby, which doesn't have the same ring to it as Pinewood Derby. That's fantastic. Well, John, thanks for joining us. I had a good time. It'll be fun to see how this comes together, since you and I have been doing this podcast over, what, the last week maybe? So how do folks get a hold of you? What can they do? Tell us more.
Well, I think, first of all, it's worth pointing out, and probably from the audio being a little flaky in bits, it's worth pointing out that I've been on this podcast at two airports, on at least one airplane, in three cars, at my house, and in two hotel rooms. So I think this is really a pretty cool idea for, you know, Vox in your podcast is really great. How do people get a hold of me? Pretty easy. I'm on the Twitter, at jcorippo, J-C-O-R-I-P-P-O. And they can email me at jcorippo@cue.org, Q.org. And Bill, thank you. This has been a really good conversation. And we'd have never had time to sit down and talk for 30 minutes like this in one place, because we're both busy like that. So I think it's a great idea, and I'm looking forward to hearing the final product.
So I'm not sure how you guys feel, but I think that recording this with Voxer over a week or two turned out pretty rad. I'm excited about it. Love to hear what sort of steamy stuff you are doing. You see what I did with that? You can tweet at John and I, Vox at us. Leave comments on the website. You can listen to this podcast on iTunes or on BillSelick.com. Either way, it's called Bill Selick Talks. because I'm Bill Selleck and this has been me talking. One final thought. Q has a new conference coming out at the end of June. Bold. Q.org/bold, another aptly and creatively named URL, walks you through kind of revamping the Mylon Hunter 7-step lesson plan program, making it actually engaging for the 21st century, the MH7, some reimagining classrooms with classroom cribs. It's going to be really cool stuff. So thanks for listening to Bill Selleck Talks.